Our first speaker will be Jose Dolores Lopez. He's the Secretary of Organizational Communications of the Independent Center for Agricultural Workers and Peasants. And this is a 40-year-old organization that fights for peasant rights to land, credit, subsidies, and their ability to produce and sell agricultural products. In his 10 years working for this organization, SIAC, he's also participated widely in the grassroots coalition El Campo No Aguanta Más. And in case you're wondering what that means, it means the countryside can't take it anymore or won't take it anymore. So he'll be talking about more about that coalition and the rising movements to protest the enactment of the North American Free Trade Agreement in Mexico. Jamie Dunn, who's here with us from Canada, is an activist, writer, and speaker who has been an advocate for the rights of citizens and workers for more than a decade. In 2000, he co-founded the Blue Planet Project, an international initiative to protect water from privatization and commodification, and most recently was a water campaigner for the Council of Canadians, a group that a lot of us have learned a lot from, as well as our other compatriots in Canada throughout the struggle against NAFTA. They really were the leaders from their experience with the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement in educating the U.S. and activists here when we were fighting against the North American Free Trade Agreement. And he fought with the Council of Canadians to protect water from the effects of globalization and trade agreements. Finally, Sherry Hunkela is the founder and executive director, as you know, of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union, the co-chair as well of the National Welfare Rights Union, the national spokesperson for the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, and a member of the Interim National Council of the Labour Party, incredibly dedicated activist. In 1991, she started the Kensington Welfare Rights Union with a group of mothers on welfare and began leading poor Philadelphian families in the struggle for living wage jobs, health care, and housing for everyone. So making this link of how trade agreements, how these larger issues are impacting the poor here in the United States is a crucial part, I think, of understanding how we can fight against these agreements and why we need to fight against free trade agreements. So it's really exciting to have that analytical link here with to share this evening. So with that, please join me in welcoming our first speaker, which will be Jose Dolores Lopez.
Buenas tardes.
Good evening.
Primero que nada quisiera agradecer la invitación que nos hacen para participar en este evento.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for the invitation to participate in this event.
Yo soy miembro de una organización campesina en México, como ya oyeron, tiene 40 años de existencia.
I'm part of an organization in Mexico of campesinos, which, as you've heard, has been in existence for 40 years.
Y nosotros hicimos un análisis acerca de la situación. Nos tocó hablar acerca de la situación que vive el campo mexicano con el Tratado de Libre Comercio.
And we analyzed the situation. We sat down and talked and figured out how the countryside in Mexico was impacted by NAFTA.
Nosotros decimos que al suscribir el Tratado de Libre Comercio, México ingresó a un mercado en el cual su agricultura no podía competir.
And we saw that upon signing NAFTA, Mexico entered into a market in which its agricultural products just could not compete.
El nivel de ingreso de los productores en Estados Unidos, el grado de desarrollo en tecnología e infraestructura.
The level of investment by agricultural producers in the United States, the level of development in terms of technology and infrastructure.
Los costos de los insumos, así como los altos márgenes de subsidios, son básicamente los puntos claves de una competencia dispar.
The cost of the inputs and the high level of subsidization are basically the key points that make for very unequal competition.
Las diferencias son tales que mientras el Congreso de los Estados Unidos autorizó el año pasado la Ley Farm Bill,
the differences are such that when the United States Congress authorized the Farm Bill last year,
que otorga a su agricultura alrededor de 180 billones de dólares,
which gives around $180 billion to agriculture.
En los años de su vigencia,
throughout the years of its term.
En este mismo lapso para México solamente alcanzaríamos los 14 billones de dólares.
During that same term in Mexico, we will only have an investment of $14 billion.
Así, por ejemplo, los amplios subsidios otorgados en los Estados Unidos no se comparan con los de México.
So clearly you can see that the high level of subsidies that agriculture in the United States received just don't compare at all to those in Mexico.
Por ejemplo, en el año de 1999 al 2001, se otorgaron a México alrededor de 7 billones de dólares como subsidios.
For example, between 1999 and 2001, agriculture in Mexico received around $7 billion in subsidies.
En tanto que para este país, el mismo periodo representa la cantidad de 95 billones de dólares.
During that same period of time in this country, agriculture received $95 billion in subsidies.
Si la comparación hacemos en términos de cuánto le toca a cada persona, tenemos que para los productores mexicanos les tocan alrededor de $72.
If we do the comparison in terms of how much money each individual farmer receives, agricultural producers in Mexico receive about the equivalent of $72 each.
Mientras que para los productores en Estados Unidos esa cantidad se eleva alrededor de $350.
Whereas for producers in the United States that level goes up to around $350.
Aún más, la reciente ley Farm Bill estadounidense amplía fuertemente los subsidios con esta ley.
And what's more, the recent Farm Bill increases U.S. agricultural subsidies quite a bit.
Profundizando las diferencias de por sí ya históricas en nuestro país.
Aggravating the already historical differences between our two countries.
Garantizando desde el presente año y hasta casi finales de la década una cantidad incomparable de subsidios.
Guaranteeing from here out to about the end of the decade a just inconceivably high amount of subsidies.
Que ante las circunstancias actuales se convierten en instrumento en contra de los agricultores de nuestro país.
Which under the current circumstances becomes an instrument against agricultural producers in our country.
Es cierto que México demuestra un aumento en cuestión de frutas y hortalizas.
It's true that Mexico shows an increase as far as fruits and vegetables.
Donde sobresalen el aguacate y el mango.
In particular, avocados and mangoes stand out.
Pero no hay que olvidar que se trata de un sector muy pequeño.
But you have to remember that we're talking about a very small sector.
Que mientras el total de las tierras cultivables en México se ocupa casi el 70% para producción de granos básicos.
Whereas of all of the farmlands in Mexico that are under cultivation, over 70% are being used to raise basic grains.
Para este sector únicamente se ocupa el 8%.
Only 8% is used of arable lands are used for this small sector.
México ha importado una gran cantidad de alimentos, principalmente granos básicos.
Mexico has imported a high level of foods, including basic grains.
Y sobre eso tengo algunos datos que quisiera darles por medio de la transparencia.
And I have some information about that I'd like to share with you on the overhead.
Resulta que México ha importado desde el inicio del Tratado de Libre Comercio a la fecha.
It turns out that Mexico has imported since the beginning of NAFTA to date.
Alrededor de 135% más.
Around 135% more.
Por lo tanto, la producción de este grano en México se ha bajado en 3.7%.
Which has had the impact of decreasing the amount of this grain produced in Mexico by 3.7%.
Lo mismo sucede con el caso del frijol, que desde el Tratado de Libre Comercio a la fecha, las importaciones han aumentado en 28.6%.
The same thing has happened with beans, as I just mentioned with corn. Since the beginning of NAFTA, the amount of beans that we import has gone up by 28.6%.
Pero lo escandaloso de esto es que en cuestión de trigo, Las importaciones han aumentado en 400%.
But the real scandal is that as far as imports of wheat, they've gone up 144%.
Y por lo tanto, la producción en el país ha bajado en 20%.
And as a result, production in the country has gone down 20%.
Contrario a lo que los analistas dicen en México,
in contradiction to what Mexican analysts say,
el precio de estos productos se ha incrementado en forma alarmante.
The price of these products has actually been going up alarmingly.
Llegando en el caso del frijol en un aumento del 571% ya transformado en tortilla.
Frijol,
o digo el maíz, perdón.
In the case of corn, for example, it's gone up 571%, which of course is reflected in the price of tortillas.
Lo mismo sucede en el caso del frijol con un aumento de 373%.
The same thing can be seen in the price of beans, which has gone up 373%.
Ya lavado y puesto el consumidor final por kilogramo.
Cleaned and offered to the consumer by kilogram.
Pero en el caso del trigo, el aumento en el precio se va hasta 400%.
And when it comes to wheat, the price to the consumer has gone up 400%.
Según informes de la Secretaría de Agricultura, el año pasado tuvimos en Sinaloa un excedente de 1,800,000 toneladas de maíz.
¿Un excedente? ¿Es decir, demasiado?
De más.
According to the Minister of Agriculture, in the state of Sinaloa, we had 1,800,000 extra tons of wheat.
De los cuales no pudieron ser comercializadas.
Which could not be sold.
Por estas importaciones.
Because of these imports.
Lo que ocurre para la agroindustria en México, que resulta que es mejor para los grandes transnacionales importar el maíz de Estados Unidos, que viene a más bajo precio y además con facilidades de crédito.
The thing that happens with agroindustry in Mexico is that it turns out that it's easier for multinational corporations to import wheat from the United States, which they can get for cheaper and they get easier terms of credit for purchasing.
Que los productores mexicanos estaban muy lejos de poder dar crédito.
As opposed to buying from producers in outlying Mexican states who can't offer such generous credit.
Bajo estas circunstancias, nuestra organización hizo un análisis de los efectos que ha traído el Tratado de Libre Comercio a la fecha.
And given all these circumstances, our organization analyzed how NAFTA has affected us since it was signed.
Y resulta que antes del Tratado de Libre Comercio, en 1993, México importó 8 millones de toneladas en total de productos agropecuarios.
And turns out that before NAFTA was signed in 93, Mexico imported 8 million tons of agricultural products. 8 million tons.
Pero ya para el 2002, las importaciones se incrementaron en 20 millones de toneladas.
But by 2002, the level of imports had gone up to 20 million tons.
O sea, hace 2.3 veces más.
Which is to say it's 2.3 times more agricultural imports.
En lo que va del Tratado de Libre Comercio, las importaciones totales son de alrededor de 136 millones de toneladas.
In the time that the NAFTA has been in effect, total imports have reached around 136 million tons.
Caso similar sucede con la carne y las frutas de clima templado y otras, entre otros productos.
We see a similar situation with meats and fruits from cooler climates and other products.
Los datos demuestran que México está perdiendo poco a poco su soberanía nacional en cuestión de alimentos.
These facts show clearly that Mexico is losing its national sovereignty, food sovereignty, bit by bit.
Por una mayor importación de estos productos.
Because imports of these products keep going up.
Según datos del Banco Interamericano de Desarrollo, México ha gastado en la compra de productos agropecuarios alrededor de 78 billones de dólares.
According to information from the International Development Bank, Mexico has spent on buying agricultural products around 78 billion dollars.
Esta cifra es mayor a la deuda interna que tiene el país, que es de 73 billones.
This is more money than the internal debt of the country, which is 73 billion dollars.
A pesar de lo que se suponía que el Tratado de Libre Comercio iba a traer inversión y apoyos y empleos al campo,
and although supposedly NAFTA was going to bring investment and support and jobs to the countryside,
esto ha sido todo lo contrario.
It's been quite the opposite.
Según datos de la Secretaría de Trabajo, el año pasado tuvimos un desempleo de cerca de 1.7%.
According to the according to the Minister of Labor, unemployment reached 1.7 million last year.
Y 800,000 de estos se relacionan básicamente con el campo.
And 800,000 of those were basically related to unemployment in the countryside.
Bajo esas condiciones les quisiera dar un dato muy personal.
Given all this background, I'd like to tell you some personal details.
Un familiar mío, un tío que producía frijol en el estado de Zacatecas.
A member of my family, an uncle who raised beans in the state of Zacatecas.
Por los efectos del Tratado de Libre Comercio, por la baja de precios y por la falta de subsidios.
Because of the effects of NAFTA, because of the decrease in prices and the loss of subsidies.
Ahora es inmigrante en el norte de Carolina.
Is now an immigrant in North Carolina.
Pero el escándalo no es ese, sino que se han detectado desde el inicio del Tratado de Libre Comercio 94 a la fecha alrededor de 5 millones de campesinos en las mismas condiciones.
And that's not the real scandal. What it is, what's really bad is that it's since the beginning of NAFTA in 94, it's been shown that around 5 million campesinos have had to do the same.
Nosotros formamos por todos estos problemas una coalición en México que agrupa 12 organizaciones nacionales que tiene el nombre de El Campo No Aguanta Más.
Because of these problems, we formed a coalition in Mexico of 12 national organizations called El Campo No Aguanta Más. The countryside can't take it anymore.
Que hemos hecho varias movilizaciones a nivel nacional, tomando carreteras, tomando puertos internacionales, tomando puertos marítimos y hasta la Cámara de Diputados en México.
And we've turned out several large national mobilizations. We've shut down large highways, we've shut down international ports, maritime ports, and we've even taken over the Legislative Assembly, our Congress.
Hasta consolidar una gran movilización que reunió alrededor de 100,000 campesinos el día 31 de enero en la Ciudad de México.
All building up to our biggest turnout, which was a big march of 100,000 campesinos on January 31st in Mexico City.
Esta coalición luchaba por 6 puntos estratégicos que creemos son importantes en la vida de los campesinos mexicanos.
This coalition came together around 6 strategic points that we think are crucial for campesinos in Mexico.
Primero que nada pedíamos que no entrara en vigor el apartado agropecuario del Tratado de Libre Comercio, que este año libera de cuotas a 19 productos.
First of all, we wanted the agricultural side agreement to NAFTA, which was supposed to go into effect this year, to not go into effect. It would lift quotas on 19 additional products.
El segundo punto era que pedíamos que se otorgaran mayores recursos a la agricultura en México en este año 2003, y lo logramos aumentando en casi 5,000 millones de pesos.
And their second point was that we wanted more resources invested in agriculture in Mexico for this year, 2000, and we managed that. Investment was increased by $5,000 million.
El tercer punto y muy importante para nosotros era que pedíamos una reforma financiera diferente en México.
The third point, which was very important to us, was we wanted financial reform in Mexico.
¿Por qué reforma diferente? Resulta que en México existen subsidios, pero prácticamente van enfocados para la gente que tiene más recursos. Pero en México existen 30 millones de campesinos que la gran mayoría de ellos no tienen ningún apoyo.
And why do we say different financial reform? Well, we do have subsidies in Mexico, but they mostly go to agricultural producers who already have resources. And there are 30 million campesinos who really don't receive significant subsidies that should be.
Por eso pedíamos una reforma diferente, que se apoyara más a este sector.
Which is why we asked for a different type of reform that would help this sector more.
El cuarto punto era que peleábamos por una asignación del 1.5% del Producto Interno Bruto del país para el campo.
The fourth point was that we wanted 1.5% of the gross domestic product to be invested in the countryside.
El quinto punto, e igual de importante, es que peleábamos porque hubiera calidad en los alimentos que consumen los mexicanos.
The fifth point, and equally important, is that we were struggling for the products, the food products that Mexicans eat to be of high quality.
¿Por qué les digo calidad en los productos de los mexicanos? Resulta que en la toma de la frontera con Ciudad Juárez, Chihuahua y El Paso.
Well, why do I mention the quality of food products in Mexico? Well, it turns out that in the borders, Ciudad Juárez, Chihuahua, and El Paso.
Descubrimos que estaba entrando maíz procedente de Estados Unidos de muy mala calidad.
We discovered that corn was from the United States was coming in that was of very poor quality.
Que era maíz amarillo producido para consumo de los animales, principalmente los puercos, y que lo estaban comprando las empresas transnacionales y transformándolo en tortilla para consumo de los mexicanos.
That was yellow corn, of very poor quality, raised primarily for animals, primarily pigs, and it was being bought by multinational corporations and turned into tortillas for the Mexican people to eat.
Lo mismo sucedió en el puerto de Veracruz, donde paramos el puerto y descubrimos que estaba entrando frijol procedente de Estados Unidos, pero frijol de contrabando chino.
And just as we discovered that when we took over the border, when we took over the port of Veracruz, we discovered that beans were coming in from the United States, but through Chinese contraband.
Que la única proteína que traía ese frijol era el animalito que se crea ya en el frijol cuando ya es viejo.
And we discovered that the only protein that those beans had was the protein that came from the little animals that show up on those beans when they're really old.
Por eso pedíamos una calidad en los alimentos que consumen los mexicanos.
Which is why we demanded quality food products from Mexican people.
El sexto punto y muy importante era que pedíamos que se reconocieran los derechos y la cultura de los pueblos indígenas en México.
The sixth very important point was that we wanted recognition for the rights and the culture of indigenous people in Mexico.
Porque en México, como en otros lados, los sectores más explotados y más reprimidos han sido los campesinos y los indígenas.
Because in Mexico, as in other places, the sectors that have been most exploited and oppressed have been the campesinos and the indigenous people.
Hemos logrado algunos avances con el gobierno federal por medio de las movilizaciones que hemos tenido.
As a result of our marches, we have made some advances with the federal government.
Y estamos prácticamente casi en condiciones de firmar en las próximas semanas un acuerdo por la salvación del campo mexicano.
And we're at the point of about to sign in the next few weeks an agreement with the government for saving the Mexican countryside.
Pero eso no es lo peor que nos puede suceder. Ahora resulta que nos quieren imponer otro tratado igual o más perjudicial que este.
But that's not the worst that can happen to us. Now it turns out that they want to put a trade agreement the same or worse than this one onto us.
Que es el Acuerdo de Libre Comercio de las Américas.
Which is the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas.
Que lo único que haría es profundizar las diferencias o la crisis que ya existe en México.
Which would only aggravate the differences and the crisis that we're experiencing in Mexico.
Pero ampliándola para todo Centroamérica y América Latina.
But amplifying it to all of Central America and Latin America.
Por eso es importante nuestra presencia aquí para nosotros y debe ser también para ustedes.
Which is why our presence here is important to us and should also be to you.
Porque es necesario parar este tipo de acuerdos que a los que más afecta son a las gentes pobres.
Because it's necessary to stop this type of agreements that affect poor people most.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jose. Please join me in welcoming Jamie Dunn.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here tonight in Seattle, yeah. And I'd like to thank Global Exchange for organizing this, but particularly the local organizers like Jeremy and the rest of his group that made tonight's event possible. And I'm from Canada. I didn't bring a translator, so you're going to have to struggle through and try and understand what I'm saying. You know, being from Canada and coming and talking to you about NAFTA and free trade in general, and being the age I am is very significant, because when the government came in that promised the kind of policies that are codified by these trade agreements, I was in that transition from being in elementary school and high school into adulthood. And for Canada, and particularly Canada and the United States, it's very important to remember that we actually elected governments that put these policies in place and then went around the world negotiating and implementing these trade agreements. For countries like Mexico and particularly countries in Central and South America, when I tell friends from Brazil what was happening in Canada in the 80s, they say, oh, you structurally adjusted yourselves? Because to them, that's bizarre. This is what the World Bank and the IMF forced in their country, but we elected governments who promised to cut out the fat, cut through job-killing red tape. In Ontario, there's actually a commission called the Commission That Cuts Through Job-Killing Red Tape, and I'm not kidding, that's the actual name. And then codified them through these trade agreements, codified those policies that diminished social programs, targeted the most vulnerable people in society, and eliminated a lot of access for people to making their lives better or even surviving. And so for us, it's really, as a Canadian, it's really remembering what Canada was like as a child, where we had broadening social programs, broadening access to education, health care, post-secondary education. And then seeing later on how those were, that deteriorated. And then how enraged Canadians were, only to find out we had signed trade agreements that meant we couldn't turn it back. Just an example, when I started university in 1984, and that wasn't that long ago, believe it or not, I paid $1,200 for a full year of school. That was everything. And I got a card, my student card was also a charge card at the bookstore, and my bus pass, and it was included. And I had ample educational loans and grants. Here's some money. Go to school. Don't pay us back. And I could pretty well get a decent summer job, not an extremely good summer job, decent summer job, raise enough money to go to school for the whole school year. And if I wanted extra spending money, I'd get a job waiting tables, work in the liquor store over Christmas, something like that. Now, not that much longer, tuition to the University of Toronto for some programs is $20,000, $30,000, up to $50,000 a year. And I know you know what that's like, to get out of school with an enormous burden or just to go to school thinking, you know, I'm going to be able to handle this, but right now I'm going to put my head down and get through school. And for more and more Canadians, that simply means that within a generation, you've gone from coming out of high school, assuming you're going to go to university, to hoping your kids don't go to university. I've got two kids. I hope they don't go to university. You know, my six-year-old wants to be a rock star. That's great. Not only will I not have to pay for university, but he'll probably be able to support me for the rest of my life. Similarly, programs like healthcare and education, even elementary school education, have been eroded. Healthcare in Canada is part of our national heritage, and it's a really a big crisis in Canada right now, because something we've prided ourselves on, particularly in the North American context, a universal healthcare system that people get access to based on what their illness is, not based on how much money they have in their pocket, is under threat by rising prices. And particularly when we're talking about NAFTA, one of the biggest rising prices in healthcare is prescription medications. And NAFTA guarantees pharmaceutical companies a 20-year patent protection on their medications, making it impossible to bring in cheaper generics earlier on for people who need them. So it's important to see that what the trade agreements did in North America, particularly in Canada and the United States, is actually lock in these kind of policies, because Canadians were furious by 1993. I mean, their entire social safety net had been eroded. Their traditions had been eroded. And so the government that brought them in, the Conservatives, went from the biggest majority in the Canadian history to having only two seats in the House of Commons. And Prime Minister Brian Mulroney was universally hated, like hated, deeply loathed. And the government that came in were the Liberals saying, we're going to return Canada to its earlier prosperity, its earlier social justice, and we're not going to sign NAFTA. Well, no sooner had they gotten in than they said, oh, well, we've got the environmental side agreement and the labor side agreement. It's going to protect the environment and jobs. We don't have to worry. All our concerns are taken care of. Oh, so we can sign. What we found out now is those don't work. And one of the main reasons they don't work is Chapter 11, which some of you may know about and some of you may not know about. Chapter 11 is the part of NAFTA that allows private corporations to sue governments where they feel their profits have been eroded, or it's called expropriated. And it doesn't only mean they had a business and their profits disappeared because of government regulation. It means that they have the right to invest to make a profit and they can't be stopped from investing, which means they don't even have to invest. to be able to sue for all the money they ever would have made. And now we've got some examples, because people didn't believe that when we were saying, you know, Chapter 11's a nightmare, the whole agreement's a nightmare by protecting investors. People say, you're crazy. That's impossible for something to operate like that. Well, what we've got are some decisions now to base that claim on. So we have the MMT scenario, where the government of Canada bans a gasoline additive made in the United States because of human health worries about low-level manganese. And Ethyl Corporation from Virginia sues Canada under Chapter 11. And because we know we're going to lose, the government of Canada knew it was going to lose, not only because it actually interfered with the profits of this company, but the company also sued because one of our elected representatives had the audacity to stand up in the House of Commons and suggest there was something wrong with their product, and that cut into their profitability. That we repealed the law, paid Ethylcorp $13 million U.S., about $20 million Canadian, and gave them a letter saying there's nothing wrong with MMT, which they use around the world to force it into poor countries. At the same time, the Environmental Protection Agency in the States hadn't even improved MMT, and it was not in use in any American state. That's MMT. In the early 90s, during a drought in Southern California, a company named Sunbelt, an American company, wanted to export Canada's water from British Columbia down to California, and the British Columbia government said no. So they're suing Canada under Chapter 11 for $10.5 billion. That's about $16 billion or $17 billion Canadian, because they can sue for all the money they ever would have made, and they never actually exported one drop of water. And one of the reasons Canadians and the Canadian provinces are so upset about that scenario is because if BC had started exporting water, or if this shows that BC should have exported water, it would open the door on the entire country for water exports. And I know it's funny, you know, a few years ago when there was an attempt to export water from the Great Lakes, a joint commission between Canada and the United States looked at the problem and said the Great Lakes doesn't have to worry because the American Sunbelt will get its water from the Pacific Northwest. So, yeah, I think, you know, there's something in common between this region of the United States and Canada when it has to worry about water exports and the obligations NAFTA imparts. Another case, S.D. Myers. It's an American company that disposes of hazardous waste. And they wanted to start doing business with Canada and actually getting Canada to export its hazardous waste in the States so they could dispose of it, particularly PCBs. And Canada said, we can't. We belong to something called the Basel Convention, a multilateral agreement on the environment that says we can't export our toxic waste problems. So S.D. Myers sues Canada. And even though the Basel Convention is supposed to be excluded from the provisions of NAFTA, the NAFTA Tribunal awards S.D. Myers $5 million against Canada because the United States doesn't belong to the Basel Convention. That's unfair for the United States if we follow this international agreement we've signed. And the fact of the matter is the United States doesn't belong to very many multilateral agreements on the environment. So what's Canada supposed to do? Similarly with MTBE, which is a gasoline additive that 60 Minutes reports may have polluted the groundwater of 100 million Americans. When the state of California, which has enough water problems, says we're going to phase it out because we're worried about it, Methanex, a Canadian company that makes a component of MTBE, says you can't do that under NAFTA, that it cuts into our profits. We're suing the United States for $980 million. And that's already passed the part of the tribunal phase where they say whether it can go on to actually being considered seriously. So they're going to go ahead and consider that. The impact of all of this is twofold. One, Canada and Mexico have had to pay each $18 million in compensation claims under NAFTA for either protecting human health or the environment, or simply following the direction of municipalities as to what kind of area the people of those municipalities want to live in. And NAFTA Tribunal has held that even local zoning bylaws can violate NAFTA. What's happening, therefore, is that governments are becoming scared of regulating because they don't know what's going to get them sued. So when Canada says, the population in Canada broadly says, we want to ban water exports, the government comes back and says, well, we can't. It will violate our international trade obligations. We have to try and find some kind of loophole, which seems less and less and less likely. So what's that mean for Canadians as they want to recover from these ridiculous policies of the 80s? What does it mean as they deal with new problems, like an aging population? Well, for healthcare, if we have to deal with these patent protections on medications and try and get medications to people by having a national pharmacare program, well, we're cutting into the business of multinational health insurance providers who already provide health insurance, and they can sue us under Chapter 11. If we want to expand a home care program so that seniors can stay in their homes longer, maintain a higher quality of life, their dignity, and be treated in their homes, we're cutting into the business of multinational health care providers, which expanded their business or set up their business back in the 80s when we were deregulating and privatizing everything. And they can claim a judgment under NAFTA. Similarly with water providers, any service, because our Chapter 12 of NAFTA is about services, and it guarantees the right to establish a business, and just as importantly, it guarantees that if there's a dispute, it'll be handled under the rules of NAFTA, not by domestic law. So why are we showing up to vote if not only our laws don't matter when a foreign company is involved, but our governments are so scared they've stopped legislating or regulating in our interest? And that's what's happening. These agreements serve to lock in a failed economy that more and more communities, whether it's in Canada, the United States, or Mexico, want to do something about and stop the implementation of better measures to deal with old problems we haven't figured out how to deal with, like unemployment, poverty, pollution, or new problems like dealing with an aging population and thinking about what's the best way to take care of those people. And more and more and more we're having to pay a corporate ransom for our democracy. We're having to buy back our democracy every time we deal with a problem from corporations who can sue us because they see our community as a marketplace, not a place where we think about servicing ourselves and the people who need services in the community and how to best and more effectively and very often more cheaply provide essential services. And when you're talking about healthcare and education and water, you're talking about human rights. And we have to start seeing ourselves as people who have human rights and the people in our communities as people who have human rights, not just someone in the third world. And that's pretty devastating when you think about where we've gone in a very short period of time. But there's a really good news story underneath this, and that's the way we've been beating it. The way we've been beating this policy, this economy, these trade agreements, is by organizing in our community, taking our communities back at the very local level. And I'll give you some really good examples. Back in 1998, local community organizing plugged into a global network beat the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, the world's biggest investment agreement, which is like a global Chapter 11. That was beat by local organizing plugged into a global network. In Canada, when the government tried to get a water accord signed that would have actually allowed water exports, people from all over the country called their provincial ministers of the environment and said, if you sign that thing, I'll make it my personal business to make sure you never work again as an elected politician. And 5 of the 10 provinces didn't sign it. Similarly, with the GATS, the General Agreement on Trade and Services under the WTO, which is currently being negotiated, over 100 Canadian communities have passed municipal resolutions rejecting the GATS, and the Federation of Canadian Municipalities of over 200 municipalities has passed a resolution getting municipalities out of the GATS, urging the federal government, because the federal government negotiates it, rejecting it. And if it's rejected for municipalities who are more and more delivering services, it would make it fundamentally inoperable. Those are huge victories, not only in actually exerting pressure on the government, but in bringing communities together, because what's really happening as we move forward to defeat NAFTA and the coming FTAA, which would expand NAFTA and exacerbate all these problems, elevating corporate powers to sue us, elevating corporate powers to force private services into the public realm. We're also starting to talk about what we prefer, what we'd like, how we'd like to see our communities, what would be the best thing when you walk out your door to see. And so we're already talking and formulating what's going to replace this trade agreement era. As it starts to run out of steam, as it relies more and more and more on the power to force people to play by its rules, that's why they call them trade disciplines, because they have to force people to obey them. And as communities organize, we're rejecting that. We're rejecting that discipline and saying, no, our freedom is about making decisions that suit ourselves and our neighbors in a way that supports our community, and we expect environmental protections, we expect labor rights, and we expect human rights to be respected. And that's what's coming out of this movement. Together, we're forging what comes next, a better future for ourselves and our children, and one we have control of. Thank you very much.
Please welcome Sherry Hunkala.
Hello. This one you're supposed to say hello.
Hello.
You see, it's really important I feel invited in Seattle since the last time I was here. I was in jail, you know, probably with the rest of you. And this is also my last night of hearing both Jamie's and Jose's presentation. Can we have a round of applause? No. We've gotten really evil with each other throughout the week. Last night, after I was done with my presentation, I don't speak Spanish, but Jose wrote me a note in Spanish. And the translator barely couldn't even translate it for me as we were sitting up at the table because we were so famished and exhausted after 9,000 presentations. And it said, Sherry, be sure and turn the lights off when you're done with your presentation. So, let's keep the lights on. And I have written some things because I have, as Jose knows, a lot to say. We've looked at the situation in Canada and in Mexico. Now let's look at the situation here in the United States of America. As an organizer for over two decades amongst low-income families across our country, I have seen and learned many things. But before I begin, let me draw attention to some photographs that you won't see in the newspapers or hear about on CNN. The invisible people, the people impacted by NAFTA and the welfare system being dismantled. While our government spends billions of dollars on the war in Iraq and gives tax breaks to the rich, what is the situation that we're facing in our country, and what will happen if these people continue to remain faceless and silent in the United States of America? So whenever I give presentations, I pass them out. These are photographs of poor and homeless families across the country. The photographs of encampments are in this country, not in Brazil, not in Africa. $14,000 jobs have been lost in Washington because of NAFTA. 9,500 of those jobs were in manufacturing. 9.2% of the people in Washington, including 12.1% of the children that live in this state, are living in extreme poverty. 11.9% of households do not even have enough to eat tonight. And 13.2% of the people don't even have any form of health insurance. 10.1% of Washington's children are also uninsured. 38% of the tenants can't even afford to pay this month's rent. Washington's welfare rolls have drastically decreased by 39.8%. Their only way to feed, clothe, and house themselves without being guaranteed some form of employment. Unemployment rates continue to rise in this state, as a matter of fact, much higher than the national average. In Philadelphia and across the country, the situation is quite similar. I saw this as I traveled across the country in the new Freedom Bus, documenting economic human rights violations. After all, I knew that what I was watching on the television wasn't the story of my neighbors, and certainly wasn't the story of my family in the Midwest, and wasn't the story of my friends on the West Coast and around the entire country. In Kensington, where I work and live, It's an old industrial area where Mother Jones once walked with children to the United Nations after their limbs were cut off after working in factories. Today, if Mother Jones was alive, she wouldn't even have any of those factories to march from. Today, instead, what exists are vacant lots, lots and lots of polluted vacant lots, impacted by the environmental problems that have been left there by corporations that have left and have no plans of coming back. With no employment and the ending of a social welfare system, drugs are now the number one source of income in my neighborhood. On one given day, I watched as four young people were stacked on top of each other in the back of a paddy wagon and hauled away by the police department. Four young human beings. Their lives didn't even warrant an investigation. Expendable human beings. How did we get to this point, and what do we need to do in order to change it? Well, one of the things that we do is we make use of these abandoned lots, and we set up encampments, not to make political points, but out of necessity. And so we built this one particular encampment, and we named it after the person that we thought was responsible for this particular town, using the Hoovervilles of the 1930s. So it just so happened that our governor is Ridge, so we call this encampment Ridgeville. So you know the guy. He's in charge of your Homeland Security. You familiar with him? And so we named it Ridgeville, and while we had the encampment, whenever the population would go up, we'd change the population on the sign. And on one particular day, over 70 families, it was pouring rain on a regular basis, in which on the very land was a huge factory that used to provide employment for people in the community, we sat in the rain. And we were devastated one day because down the road came a couple portable Johns, and they were compliments of our Democratic mayor, Rendell, who gave us these portable Johns and said, you know, I hope this will be of some assistance. To us, we were absolutely devastated because it was like a message to us to adjust to the absolute lowest standard of living. And we, as human beings, decided that we were going to do something about it, so we marched for the next 10 days to Harrisburg, 22 miles a day, so that we could have a discussion with our governor about what we were going to do about jobs in Pennsylvania and what we were going to do about factories leaving our community. And when we arrived there, he didn't even send out the janitor. So being resourceful people that we are, we decided to move into the Capitol Rotunda. And if you've ever been a person that has gone without heat or running water or the use of a regular toilet, there's no words to describe how absolutely excited we were. And as a matter of fact, we were able to learn a lot about politics that night, you see, because they were having a bipartisan event that night of champagne and caviar. And the head of the Democratic Party came over to us and told us that if we went to the end of the hallway, we could have free box lunches. If we could just do that until their event was over with, certainly we could understand and cooperate. And one of the homeless mothers said, we marched for 10 days. We don't intend to be invisible today. And that something has to be done. Needless to say, it was the shortest event in the entire state of Pennsylvania. They quickly had their champagne and left. We took the leftovers. It was the only right thing to do. And we continued to live in the Capitol Rotunda. We got to know all of the workers. I'm not talking about our elected officials now. The workers, the custodians, they brought us their children, and they'd say, these are the homeless kids, and our kids would say, hello. And we even witnessed a couple weddings while we were there. We were able to take the bouquets, and these were good friends of the governor's. That's how you get a wedding in the Capitol. But anyway, so one day came, and they decided that the public building, the Capitol building, was no longer going to be a public building, but was actually going to have a closing time, and nobody was going to be permitted in the Capitol. That's how quickly things changed, right? From being public to whatever. So we decided we were going to sit there and all of us were going to get arrested, and we were going to force a dialogue with our governor. And instead, he called out about 75 state troopers, placed 4 state troopers on every family that was in there, and literally physically carried us out and plopped us on the front stairs. Again, we were incredibly resourceful. So the next day, when the governor planned to go to church, which is across the street from the Capitol, we had a huge blue tarp, which we painted, "There by the grace of God go I, welcome to Ridgeville." So an effort to make us incredibly invisible now turned into the governor's nightmare. He stopped going to church, and we lived on the Capitol stairs, and the governor was absolutely furious, so he decided to write an editorial into the local Patriot News. And he wrote the editorial, which was, "I don't understand it. The homeless people have made their point. Now they just need to go home." "It's all right. He's in charge of your safety." So as we were on the Capitol stairs, we thought, you know, this is going to produce something, some kind of, we wrote up a new plan for Pennsylvania. We were going to talk about employment, we were going to talk about housing, all of these kinds of issues, and then we got a notice that we were going to be evicted from our public Capitol stairs. But we thought, no problem, we'll just, you know, contact legal services, and they'll get an injunction, they'll stop the eviction from the Capitol stairs. And then the head of legal services came and sat down next to me and said, "You know, Sherry, the reality is that the governor's threatened to take $1 million out of legal services budget, and we're not in a position where we can risk it. So tomorrow at noon, you will all be evicted from the Capitol public stairs." So, again, we're creative. We decided to organize a tour of the governor's mansion at the exact same hour. So several caravans of women and little children and stuff, we went and we toured the governor's mansion, and we came back, and they had taken yellow tape and corridored about the space of the size of this room off as a crime scene. And thrown away our tarps for tents and all of the belongings of the homeless families. And we held a press conference on those Capitol stairs, and the women and children were able to talk about how they felt like the governor's dogs lived better than them. But the worst part that happened is about 2 o'clock that morning, after we wrapped ourselves in blankets and stayed on the Capitol stairs, the governor ordered the removal of the blankets on the coldest day in October. So we went down to Sheets grocery store 2 blocks away and got plastic and cardboard and wrapped ourselves and the children and walked through the night so that they wouldn't die from hypothermia. And that's how we came to understand both the importance of us ensuring that we don't remain invisible and the importance of using a human rights framework. Because it was that night that we really came to understand, not through some academic courses or books, that we were considered to be less than human beings. So we have dedicated our lives to ensuring that the powers that be in our country and the transnational corporations that want to ensure that you never see or hear the stories or see the faces of those that have been impacted by NAFTA and welfare reform and all of the other horrible things that are taking place, that those voices are heard from and that they are seen. Another war is taking place in this world, and that fight is for our very lives. With 765,000 people who have lost their jobs as a result of NAFTA and 33,000 family farms now gone, and 44 million people with absolutely no health insurance, and soon the poor will also have to rely on not having access to public services as we begin to privatize more and more of them, and as we no longer have access to water because we don't have the money in order to purchase it, we must begin to deploy people in this fight to end the war that's taking place at home. So what is the Kensington Welfare Rights Union and the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign doing about it? We're fighting for the unity and the organization of the poor to stop the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas. And we're linking the unemployed to organized labor. Many of our members used to be members of organized labor. The only difference now is that they don't have the money to pay their union dues. They went to the factory one day, it closed down after working there and becoming active union members for 25 years, and now they've become members of our organization. And we're also fighting to make the invisible visible. And we're also ensuring that people understand the stereotypes that surround the poor in this country, that the enemy benefits from us continuing to think that the poor looks like somebody other than the person sitting right next to you in this room. Poor people love their children. We have work ethics. The majority of the people that have so-called lived on the dole in this country are actually white. We need to begin to confront these stereotypes and not act like it's some kind of catchy disease or pretend to the rest of the world that we don't have human rights violations taking place here at home. I do this because I'm not un-American. I love my country. I love it so much that I want to start telling the truth. I've been to the demonstrations and stuff taking place in Canada, and those are much larger demonstrations than what's taking place here. The mobilization and the demonstrations that are taking place in all of South America are absolutely huge. We have our homework to be done. We need to start to get to know our neighbors once again and encourage them to join the fight, that it's not a scary fight, it's a necessary fight, and that they're important and that they need to get involved. You can also do something by supporting our efforts, by logging on to our website, and by also joining us again on August 2nd, as we commemorate the 35th anniversary of the Poor People's Campaign of Dr. Martin Luther King, as we march again for 3 weeks to the seat of power in Washington, D.C., and spend a week trying to take those that have been impacted by our government's policies and ensuring that these people are visible in Washington, D.C. And for us, this is just the beginning, because we want you to then join us again in Cancun as we demonstrate against the WTO, and again in November as we battle to ensure that we don't expand NAFTA with the FTAA. And lastly, get involved in the local organizations that are fighting to educate and organize people here. Lastly, as an old cowboy philosopher once said, speak the truth, but ride a fast horse. Thank you.